So if everyone wants to give Craig a big toss now, a welcome before he starts, you have a chance to unmute just to say hi. But then we will all be unmuted.
Hi. Hi,
Hi.
welcome, Craig. Thanks for speaking.
Knock him alive, Craig.
Oh, we can
All
hear you,
right.
Joe. Perfect.
It's good to see the wind
And
blowing in your hair, Joe.
to make you feel at home, there's a
Oh.
Maple Leafs top. So
Wow.
yeah. Yeah. Doesn't fit Patrick great, but it fits me great. Joe or Craig, take as long as you want.
Right. Thank you. I saw Pat sent me the invite for the meeting, and it had a wee Canadian flag, and then it had the Scottish coat of arms as well, which I appreciated that nod to the Scottish heritage. Thank you for that. If that was you, Mark, thank you. I'm not sure who did that. Anyway, I'm Craig, and I'm an alcoholic, 100%. Thanks for asking, Mark. Appreciate it. I don't know why. I'm a bit of a, as to use my Scottish heritage, I'm a bit of a football fanatic. So I still play. I will play until I can't play any longer. And I normally play on Wednesday nights. But when Pat relayed the message from Mark, I think a combination of I've been out of town and I'm a little bit tired, and it's about 35 degrees with smog. I thought maybe this is a good excuse not to play soccer tonight. So that's the truth. And also I thought it might be nice to reconnect with some fellow travelers, to be honest with you. Yeah. So sometimes when people reach out to me or whatever, I kind of listen to that instinct, if you will, and I decided to listen to that instinct. So here I am. Don't know what you're going to get necessarily tonight, but I will start with I'm just feeling very I'm feeling a lot of things these days. It hasn't been a it's been an interesting last few years. But today I was filled with some joy because, I was speaking with my daughter, who is going to start university and is going to be looking at a residence room tomorrow. I get to thinking about just that sentence, my daughter and university is it's very powerful for me. In the sense of where I've come from in this journey of recovery. She's right now out in Edmonton, Alberta, visiting my niece. And there's a lot of emotion tied up in my niece because my niece is the daughter of my oldest brother who passed away tragically young and left my nieces fatherless when they were 12 and 14. When I that was back in 1998, and I was just closing in on the end. I didn't know at the time, of course, but I was closing in on the end of my career as an addict and an alcoholic. I was estranged from them up until about 2010. So I didn't see them for 12 years. And through happenstance and recovery for sure, and finding some courage to reach out, kind of following some of the steps. I am, in some senses, a traditionalist. I went through the process and reaped some rewards. I mangled the process incredibly and didn't really follow any kind of strict guidelines, but it allowed me to have that courage to reach out to them. And they, so to think of my daughter with my nieces right now is it's really it's kind of mind-blowing to me, right? So definitely some thankfulness about that. Yeah, my alcoholism started pretty young. I'm gonna tell you this quick anecdote. So when I was between 10 and 13, 14. I'm the son of Scottish immigrants. So I'm first generation Canadian. My brother Ian and I were born here. My two older brothers were born in Scotland in a small town called Bathgate, in between Edinburgh and Glasgow. And there was lots of trauma that my family brought from Scotland for sure, to Canada. Not just religious trauma, but lots of other traumas and things that I didn't find out about until later. My mother's brother was an alcoholic, my Uncle John, and his wife Moira, my Aunt Moira, were really, really. My mother used to tell me about the damage that alcohol did to her family. And in those ages, 10 to 13, my mother used to go over in Scarborough here, not far. I would take a bus with her on a weekend. And I think in retrospect, she wanted to show me some things, and I saw some things. I saw the tragedy of alcoholism in action, right? My mom used to go clean the house because it was in horrible, it was a hovel, a horrible state. She would go and help Moira clean up. My Uncle John just worked all the time. He was a security guard, so he wasn't around a lot, but Moira couldn't. And they had two kids, Heather and Angela, who fucked off very young. Like they had to get out of Dodge. One of them was like 12, and the other one was 16. And the 16-year-old took the 12-year-old out of the chaos, and they ended up in South Africa. That's a whole other story. But so I saw this craziness of alcoholism, and I also, a couple of years later, my Aunt Moira died on the streets of Toronto, exposed to the elements. They found her. I don't remember exactly the location, but it was in the dead of winter, and she died, right? And so I even saw the tragic end of chronic alcoholism. And at that time, I don't know if anybody else can relate to this, but I told my mother and family that that was not going to be me. That was not going to be me. And until I was between 14 and 15, and yeah, I did this, right? I took a drink, and this, I don't know if it was bred into me, but I had an anxiety, I had a fearfulness, I had a worry about everything. And it alleviated that. It brought a sense of it's going to be okay. And I was fooled, of course, because I thought it was my friend and my coping mechanism, for a good number of years, and had lots of different flags. I call them flags. I heard a speaker say it once, where in some sports games, in American football, if there's a penalty on the field, they throw an orange flag out onto the field, and someone's done something wrong. Well, I was getting a lot of orange flags flown in my direction, from people who cared about me dearly, to people who didn't, who were just like, fuck, man. Yeah, if I flash forward, so just lots of chaotic things happening. And left Toronto in the early 90s to go out to the West Coast with my brother, Ian, who is my last remaining family of origin brother that I communicate with. I have another brother who's connected to those rough last few years that I've been through, that has had some trauma resurface as a result of that, that I've worked through, because I've shared about it and I've talked about it, and I've felt the feels. And there's a couple of, well, more than a couple. If you don't know, that wonderful Kathleen in the box there is my other half, my better half, as they say. And she has listened to me, Pat, my friend Joff, others who have just, heard me when I needed to be heard, through a process. When I was out in the West Coast, I just a couple of other examples of, I really had good intentions, and I heard someone once say that alcoholism robbed them of their potential, and I really do think that that applies to me. I went out there with the intention of playing music. My brother Ian, It probably didn't help my whole sense of not really feeling worthwhile being the kid with a brother who's 15 years older than me. That was my oldest brother, Robert, and I was the last runt of the litter, as they say. And the next brother in front of me, Ian, was 7 years, 7 years older than me. And so I started hanging out with him pretty young because there was access, right? And of course, Ian had no idea that I was on a different trajectory with my use and abuse of alcohol and drugs. So, 15-year-old hanging out with 22-year-olds. He was in a band. I hung out with the band, got to play a bit. And haunts in Toronto. His Hotel Isabella and Ag's Head. I don't know if Joe's still here. He probably knows all these places. Others may who grew up in Toronto as well, maybe Xanner. And I was having the time of my life. And then in the early 90s, anytime anybody came to me, it was about my drinking. It was they were I had it under control. That was basically the short answer of it, right? Even though there were jackpots. I mean, I was getting rehydrated in North York General when I was 16, but I could drink an incredible, I don't know, I put it down to my Scottish heritage. I was able to drink an incredible amount of alcohol for such a wee lad. People were astounded by it. And I'm not saying that because this is a some sort of competition, but it even astounded me in retrospect, right? So, but that's how I ended up in hospital because I did end up in some bad medical situations. And even doctors like, keep this up, you're not going to be above ground. Well, I had some pretty stark warnings pretty early on that I chose to ignore. I wasn't really ready. So around 19 when not 1998, I spent the better part of 8 years with this dream of playing music with my brother in on Vancouver Island and in Vancouver. And this is when I think Ian first started to see. So I'm in my early 20s now, and I just the bottom line is that when gigs would happen, I would be already have drank a whole shitload of alcohol. Then get to the gig and put on this ruse that I was just having my first beer for the night, and then smoke a big joint and end up on my ass and unable to participate. And this was embarrassing, and I felt so I really started to feel like, okay, like I'm not getting a grip on this, right? But of course, I had a job, I had a little apartment, but even at that stage, the apartment went from, I can get a nice decent one bedroom to, I ended up in a room, right, with a two plate hot stove thing and the toilet and everything in one room. So there were lots of little signs that I just kept saying, it's not that bad yet. And I would minimize it. It's kind of similar to what I would minimize my traumas or the things that I went through as a child in a chaotic household. When I got into recovery, and I know that Pat helped me a lot about this with discounting things that were very, very impactful to me, because it wasn't as bad as what Joe Blow went through or I've learned a lot about that's not what this is about for me. So 1998 comes along, and from about 95 to 98, my brother Robert, the father of those that niece that I spoke about, there's another niece who still lives on Vancouver Island, Shannon, and they're both in my life. He got sick. He got really ill, and he had kidney disease and some heart issues, and I think more than any of the other stories of my brother finding me outside in front of the provincial legislature in downtown Victoria, sleeping on the lawn, and all these other little, anecdotes about where alcohol took me. What really was the beginning of my the end of my career with drinking was when my brother was sick. I would tell, for example, my employer and other people, because I was becoming functioning was becoming harder and harder, and I had sort of drunk myself into isolation. I wasn't a bar drinker. I would, me and the dial a bottle guy were really good friends, right? Got to that kind of a stage, right? And I would tell people that I was looking after my brother. I would tell my employer that I had to go and babysit my nieces because my brother was in hospital and his wife was at, like, stuff that piled on the shame and the guilt so thick that I just, was not able to look at myself with any sort of love or worthwhileness or kindness or anything. I was a moral cretin, which of course just fueled more drinking. And my brother died in 1998. And so from 98 until 2000 was a 2-year debacle of craziness, and which culminated eventually in my brother picking me up and bringing me out of Victoria, which is on the island, like a main city. And then I went up to Courtenay, where he was staying. And on the drive up there, even though Ian and I had been through a lot of times where he'd seen me not able to function because I had drank too much or smoked too much or whatever, or put too many, drops on my tongue. It was a memorable moment for me in my recovery because I couldn't make it to his home in Courtenay. It's about a 3-hour drive. I didn't realize how much of a, how much drink was part of what I was doing all the time. Excuse me. And I couldn't make it, and I got the, I got the jitters, and I had to ask him to stop at a liquor store. And I went into the liquor store, and I got a little Mickey, and I came back out to the car, and I just had this moment of, like, he was looking at me like he finally kind of, he was bewildered, but also just in shock of that. Wow, my little brother needs alcohol so much that he needs to stop. And I was just, I need to do this, Ian, right? And it kind of dawned on me at that moment that this was way out of my control any longer. So that's just kind of a little bit of that story of how I got to finding a way to recovery. And so when I said I was traditional, I ended up, Ian, I had some wild times up there, right? Lots of, I'm just going to do this for the last time, and I'm going to do this for the last time. And then finally, like, I had a mushroom experience like I'd never had in my life. I was being crushed by the sky, which I still remember it. And Ian remembered, he told me, he came and visited last summer, and he's like, remember when you told me that you were touching the stars? So that there was some interesting things. He remembers more of some of my adventures than I do. And so that reconnection, though, with Ian, was really important for my recovery. Came back to Ontario in the summer of 2000, and played around a little bit more, went down to Toronto to some old haunts again. It just didn't feel the same anymore. There was just something that page had turned, right? And I went to some AA meetings because I knew about AA because when I was 18 at the Peanut Plaza, it's called, in Toronto near Fairview Mall, my father took me to an AA meeting, and he implored me. And I said, some people who love me said, just try this. We've seen this before. Try it. We've seen this. Like, this is a family who have lived with the trauma of alcoholism and seen it firsthand. So I went to an AA meeting when I was 18. And I even went down to the Donwood Institute, a recovery center in Toronto. And I went down, and I did this to placate others. And yeah, I remember even at that Donwood Institute, they told me after going for some day programming that I had to pee in a bottle. And I was like, offended by that, of course, because I'd already had my little daytimer book and I had not drank for 7 days. Like, that's fucking normal behavior. Like, people don't have an alcohol problem. Probably don't go, hey, I got Monday. Like, so I'm proud I got through 7 days. But of course, I'm smoking like a fucking fiend, right? Because I still got to escape this thing that's me. And so that's why you had to be totally clean to get into this outpatient program. And I was like, okay, well, that's enough of that, right? Anyway, I ended up going to AA, and I was very fortunate to meet a coven of lesbians who took me under their wing. There's a lot of irony to some of my story, in the sense of I have, throughout my recovery, and particularly queer folk have been instrumental. And the irony of that is I also have a trans daughter, so it just keeps. And I think it has enriched me. It has opened my mind. Like, we always hear keep an open mind in AA, and traditionally that was just a load of crap as far as I was concerned. It just really wasn't that. And I don't lambast AA. I mean, it saved my fucking life. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And to the point, like, when I went to those AA meetings in 2000, some folks said, you need to get your ass into a treatment center. Apparently I looked pretty distraught. So there I was up in Renison Treatment Center here, just up the road from where I live now. I went in for 3 weeks, and I was the official, I'm different. The counselors would smile at me with that wry smile as I'd tell them that I was unique. And I am unique, and I know that I'm special and I'm lovable and I'm an individual today. But what I'm talking about, of course, is my alcoholism, that somehow my version is justified or different or whatever the hell it was at the time. But anyway, those guys who I resented and hated, I ended up really appreciating what they did for me, and starting me. And yeah, I stuck around AA for, I don't know, I guess around 10 years sober. I was starting to feel a little bit inauthentic, and that's why I'm in a secular meeting today, because I didn't really feel like I was being my genuine self. And I started to speak up in my home group, and I started to say things that had heads turning and I guess would be considered controversial. And then that big controversial guy who's on the bike right now came into my life and introduced me to some other guys that were, controversial. And Joe didn't quite say it like this, but when as I was talking about stuff, he's like, well, you could start this kind of meeting. And I dilly-dallied on that for another 4 fucking years, of way, way, way. And I think he kind of said, shit or get off the pot. And so I met Bob K. Everybody knows Bob K. Actually, Joff, Mr. Jeff here from Ajax, was in our inaugural meeting when we conspired in my basement to start a secular meeting in Whitby. Jeff was there. So having Jeff here is, I can't tell you what it means to me, buddy, to have you here, right? Like, just seeing you there with your Space Age headset on is powerful for me, man. I love you so much. And you were there, man. You were in that basement, and you were, I mean, you had life and work and your own journey, and I didn't see you, but you were there, and you did come, we're a part of that magic that happened. And we started a secular meeting in 2014, and we ran that until the shit hit the fan in 2020. And then we went online, and it was around that time at the beginning of COVID that I really, I'm going to end a little bit where I started with, that the last few years have been challenging for me, right? I've had to grow and expand in ways that I never expected to. I've worked on a lot with Pat and others around getting to that place of unconditional love. And been involved in having my child come home and say, "This is who I am." And the old me from where I came from, I don't know how that would have went, to be honest with you, to where I was just like, "Okay, where do we go from here?" Right? What do I have to learn? What do I have to do? Because you're the most important thing to me. And that's kind of not how I grew up. Let's just summarize that. Right? I didn't grow up with that. I grew up with a lot of conditions and a lot of mixed messages, and I know that there was love. I know that now. And in that time I lost my dad in 2014. So much more heavy shit has gone on in recovery, that I've, as I say, it's just so important to share and to talk and to try to uncover who I am and find that love. Because for me, and I've learned even more about that from my daughter in terms of just love. That's what it is. And from 20 after my father died in 2014, I have another brother who we had some challenges, and I had challenges with my mother, and I got to the place of being well enough and strong enough that I was not, I didn't speak to my mother until 20. I didn't know I didn't speak with my mother after 2015. So I was estranged from my mother by my own choosing because it was time. Right? I could no longer have my family be abused or vulnerable. And we I tried for a number of years, but we couldn't find a place. And so she stayed with my brother. And I never really thought about this until right now, but I didn't speak to my mother from 2015. And in 2020, I got a call right when COVID hit. So I'm fucking walking into a hospital, and I think it's like fucking, we're all gonna be zombies and it's the end of the world. And I gotta go in and get in a hazmat suit to go in and see my mother because I don't know if she's going to make it. And my mother is incapacitated, and upon reflection, was very graceful that she could not speak. So I got to sit in a hospital room with my mother for about an hour while Kathleen waited in the car with my daughter. And I told her everything that I wanted to tell her. And she couldn't say anything back to me. That had never happened before. My mother always had something to say back to me. Why I was wrong, why I was misguided, why I was right. So that might not sound like a gift to people, but it was for me to go in and share that. And I gotta tell you, a lot of it was just love. A lot of it was just telling her that I loved her. And I knew she loved me. Powerful. She passed away in January of 2021. And a whole new hell broke loose at that point because I was a co-executor with that brother who was not well and went through another period of time where I wasn't prepared to do it. Spoke to some folks, got to a place where it's what I wanted to do and what I needed to do. And I did it. I didn't think I could do it, guys. I didn't think I could go through having to deal with a very abusive brother and a very challenging circumstance. But with others and love and support, I got through it and came out the other side. And I'm okay that I don't speak with that brother anymore. That's okay. And that was a process. So it's just been a little bit relentless for the last few years. And then I went through some stuff professionally where there were I spent a lot of time being accused of some nefarious or really unkind things. And I was, not always, but there were many times that I was actually guilty of those behaviors, but I was in denial about those behaviors. So I, that's not what I meant. Or, it was just a lot of sickness. And when I went through some things professionally where I was accused of some things that were false. They were not the case. And certainly there was some. I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but talking about sex or anything to do with that in my household or growing, like, that's just, fuck, are you kidding me? That's not in the narrative in a Cameron household. Having a daughter and I work with a youth from 17 to 22, and it's just, wow, I'm really proud of the ability of young people to talk openly and honestly about their, who they are, their preferences, and all the rest of it. It just presses the shit out of me, right? And that's what I want. And so I kind of took that on. And of course, that was, I would say, misinterpreted, misheard. It certainly wasn't meant to cause harm to anybody else. It was just me embracing a new narrative, a new dialogue that's open and honest and with love. But it was not taken in the way that I had intended. And it was incredibly traumatic, to go through that process and come out the other side. And I'm still dealing with some PTSD from that. I have to tell you guys, because it comes up in certain instances. Like, just, I've been out of town for a couple of days up at our main campus, and it was a bit of a struggle, because sometimes I picture that again, and I'm going to be in a similar environment, and it just triggers me at times. And I know it's going to be take some time, and I got to be patient with myself, and I have to look after myself and go through that, right? And I'm getting there for sure. With some help from some friends, some professional help. Kathleen turned me on to a wonderful woman who is just, these people just come out of the, seemingly out of nowhere to support you and provide guidance. And Sue has just been incredible in terms of helping me process. So I guess bottom line is, I couldn't do any of this alone. I am, my life is nowhere near what I've would have thought of how it would have turned out, but it is now firmly entrenched in love and kindness and at times messiness and mistakes. And it's okay. It just is. So I think I'm running out of steam, guys. I appreciate you listening, and it's good to be staring at a screen. It's been a little while. I've been a little bit out of a hiatus, so it's good to be back and sharing. Thanks again, Mark, for letting me share.